May it please the court. Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jeff Baines, number 44369, and I represent the respondent appellant, Marilyn Marks. My colleague, Robert McGuire, number 37134, is also counsel of record in this case on behalf of Ms. Marks. As a preliminary matter, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of my time today for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case raises two distinct questions that I hope to address today. The first question is a fairly straightforward one, concerning whether a specific exception exists under CORA for the inspection of voted paper ballots. The second question is far more complex, concerning a municipality's ability to override CORA and deny its citizens the right to inspect public records. I'll address these questions in that order because the district court appears to have begun its analysis with the assumption that 3110.616 controls the outcome of this case. And we do not disagree. Indeed, that conclusion flows from our belief that statewide CORA controls here, and CORA is construed with an eye to exceptions set out elsewhere in state law. The district court in this case correctly noted that an exception exists under CORA where disclosure of records at issue would be contrary to state law. But the district court incorrectly concluded that a provision for the preservation of voted paper ballots prohibits the inspection of such ballots under CORA. As a preliminary matter, this was a simple error of statutory construction. CRS section 3110.616 provides that except when needed for purposes of election contests, voted paper ballots must remain in ballot boxes for 6 months following an election, or until such time as they are no longer needed for purposes of contests, at which point they must be removed and destroyed. From this language, the district court inferred that the statute assumes and strongly suggests that the inspection of voting paper ballots is prohibited. The district court further noted that the statute expresses a policy against public inspection of voting paper ballots. What the district court did not find as a predicate to its holding, however, was that the inspection of voting paper ballots was specifically accepted by the statute. That was a finding that was required by this court's holdings in Carpenter versus Civil Service Commission and Denver Post versus University of Colorado, both of which are cited in our briefs, where this court reiterated the notion that the general policy of CORA is that all public records are open to inspection unless specifically accepted by law. Instead, the district court created a new exception from CORA through its broad interpretation of a ballot preservation provision. And this, of course, is the opposite of what this court required Colorado courts to do in its decision in Freedom Newspapers v. Tolleson.
Mr. Baines, you don't read the provision of the statute that says the ballots must remain in the ballot boxes to be a specific exception to CORA?
No, I don't, Your Honor, because I think the natural extension of that, if you were to take that to its extreme and say that they cannot be removed unless, you know, unless it's for the purpose of election contests, as 3110.616 reads, then you wouldn't be able to do the other things that you need to do in the conduct of post-election, so canvassing or recounts. You couldn't remove them for that purpose either, but clearly the ballots are allowed to be removed for that purpose. I think the idea here is that it's a second part of 3110.616 that really gives you the guidance as to what the intent of the statute was, which is really to protect the anonymity of ballots and the disclosure of how people voted by virtue of having letting people take a look at the ballots themselves. But in a day when, after the Constitution has been amended and ballots can't be marked in such a way that that the person who voted them, their votes, their identity can be revealed, that requirement is no longer necessary. And certainly, even if it were necessary, a clerk can comply with that while removing the ballots for purposes of an inspection.
If the clerk were to remove the ballots, would the clerk be in violation of that particular portion of the statute, though?
Well, if you were to read it as it's written, and take the position that that does cause a violation, then like I said, it would also cause a violation if they remove the ballots for purposes of a recount, and that can't possibly be the case. Ballots are removed all the time.
But we're looking at it in the context of CORA only, not in the context of other election contests, canvassing, etc. Right.
That is true, but I think to construe the statute in a way that makes sense, you'd need to take into account those other statutorily mandated provisions. RCORA exists in the same footing as the provisions that require canvassing and recounts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I was saying, the this court's decision, Freedom Newspapers v. Tolleson, pointed out that any exceptions to RCORA have to be construed narrowly, not broadly, as the district court did here. Moreover, the conceptual underpinning of this issue was already addressed by this court in favor of Ms. Marks in Marks v. Cook.
Mr. Baines, in that case, I thought the division simply said that 3110.616 didn't apply because they were talking about photocopies there and not paper ballots. Isn't it a fair inference from that the division thought maybe the statute did apply if paper ballots were an issue?
I think what the division said is that they didn't need to reach the question of whether 3110.616 applied,
okay,
because they were talking about photographic images of ballots.
But in any event, they didn't decide that the statute was
in. They didn't decide it, certainly, Your Honor. But I think what's important to note from that case is that the conceptual underpinning of the case, which is that the contents of ballots are indeed subject to core inspection. So in other words, whether they're TIF files or they're voted paper ballots, I think you can extend the same reasoning to voted paper ballots. The contents of the ballots themselves, regardless of their form, are subject to inspection under core, absent some marking on the ballot.
Let me ask a different question, counsel. What happened to the ballots here? Are they still in the boxes? Have they been preserved or have they been destroyed?
It's my understanding that they've been preserved. There was, I believe, the city applied for an order to preserve the ballots and not have to pull them out for 6 months for destruction. I believe that's where they sit now.
Before you go to the Aspen Ordinance, could I just ask you one more question about state law? We now have a new law that's in place since you were in the trial court here, I believe.
Right.
Under this new law, HB 12-1036, would your client, would the city be required to give your client access to the paper ballots?
Yes, the city would be required to give.
Okay, so now it's, I don't know, I mean, I don't know that, could you not simply reapply?
Yes, and indeed we argued that this case became moot as a result of the passage of HB 12-1036 at the district court level. The case was pending at the district court level, and a decision hadn't been rendered yet when HB 12-1036 was passed, and our view is that from a practical perspective, then the issue before this court, before the district court, ceased to exist as a live issue.
So did you then, or did either side, did move to dismiss the case as moved for lack of jurisdiction, or move to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction?
Based on largely on timing concerns, we actually did that through our Rule 59 motion following the decision, but we did make that argument at that point.
Counselor, and I want to mention that although the House Bill 12-1036 amended CORA, it did not amend 3110.616, correct? There has not been any specific amendment of 3110.616, correct?
That's right, and I think that's very important, Your Honor, because what it suggests is that when the legislature looked at this issue and decided that they voted paper ballots were subject to disclosure under CORA, they didn't see any conflict with 3110.616. They didn't even reference the statute in the adoption of HB 12-1036. So they must not perceive the problem. If the voting paper ballots could be allowed to be inspected without impairing that statute or without requiring clerks to violate that statute.
Have you looked at the legislative history of the House bill to see if there's anything in there that helps us in interpreting these statutes?
There's been a lot of discussion throughout of the period of the last probably 20 years about what is allowed, whether the inspection of voted paper ballots is allowed under CORA, and ultimately there was some back and forth in the legislative history, but nothing I think it's conclusive on this point. We would take the position that the fact that 3110.616 was left untouched through the passage of HB 12-1036, I think that's telling.
I believe your opponent suggested in his answer brief that if you look at the first paragraph of the new legislation, it says by enacting this section, the General Assembly intends to permit the inspection of ballots under the specified conditions. And I think he argued that that suggests an intent to change the language rather than simply, or to change the law rather than simply clarify existing law. And I didn't see a response to that in your answer brief or your reply.
Of course, the laws that existed, we believe, was a function of the first Mark C. Cook case, which was decided probably 5 or 6 months earlier. And in that case, again, the conceptual point is that the contents of ballots are subject to inspection under CORA, if not specifically in voted paper form in that case. That of course, is the purview of this case. But in Mark C. Cook, it became clear that the contents themselves were, of course, subject to inspection under CORA. I'd like to go ahead and reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, please, the court. My name is James R. True, attorney registration number 9528. I'm the city attorney for the city of Aspen, and I'm here today representing Catherine Cook, who's the clerk for the city of Aspen, the plaintiff appellee hearing. As you know, the clerk, in fact, instituted this litigation following CORA requests that were submitted to her for the examination of the cast election ballots in the 2011 Aspen municipal election. This case is first and foremost about the interpretation of 3110.616, and I believe Judge Casebolt got to the crux of the position that we have been taking throughout this case. In the case, the previous case of Marks v. Cook, and in 11 briefs that have been submitted by the by Ms. Marks in this case, not once have they really attempted to answer the question that Judge Casebolt posed to them, and that's, what does Section 3110.616, subsection 1 mean? And the language is very clear. The ballot shall remain in the box unless they're required for election contest. And that provision about requiring for election contest is consistent with the constitutional scheme that started in 1876 and was amended in 1946. And as part of what we have asserted throughout these cases is that the Constitution protects secrecy in voting. And 3110.616 follows that statutory scheme. It can only be removed from the ballot box for the purposes of examination by in a court contest. Not through CORA, only in a court contest. And that's the first exception that's set forth in that phrase that they never attempted really until today to explain. And even today, they can't explain what these terms really mean. There are three exceptions in the statute about when you can remove the ballots from the ballot box. For an examination of a court contest, if a court contest is ongoing, then it can be removed for the purposes if there's a special election and you need the ballot boxes. But there's an important section in that phrase that is important to note, because under that second circumstance, there's a court contest, but there's a special election and the boxes are needed, the clerk may remove the ballots, but the clerk shall preserve the ballots in some secure manner and provide for their being kept so that no one can ascertain how any voter may have voted. Secrecy in voting is important in 3110.616.
Pardon me, counsel, but your opponent contends that even if the ballots themselves were reviewed, there still wouldn't be any way to determine how any particular voter did vote because of the way that the request was made, that if there were any particular markings on the ballot that indicated in other words, it should only have reported what the vote was, not who the voter was.
Well, I understand that, and the distinction that's been set forth throughout these cases is that if there are markings on the ballot, anonymity can be lost. But anonymity can be lost in a number of ways, not just through the intentional markings of the ballots. There can be voting patterns that lose in anonymity, and there can be, along with specific voted or specific marks.
Isn't that continuing to be a concern under the new statute as amended? Don't you have exactly the same concerns that you did before about whether you can discern how someone voted based on their voting patterns?
Well, and I recognize that, and I think it's crucial to this discussion, because what the legislature, what the court in Marks v. Cook did was delegate that determination of whether the marks were identifiable to the clerk. And what the history of the secret ballot, the history of the law that supports this, says is that the secret ballot is a personal right, and it's a right that has to be as vigorously maintained after the election as it is before the election. And that discussion starts in 1897. It continues to Gray v. Hunley in 1925. And granted, in 1946, there was an amendment to the Constitution regarding the...
I hate to interrupt your history, but we have limited time. So my question is, isn't it true that even under this amendment to the new statute, that these ballots, had they been requested, at least in your view, after this amendment went into effect, would have had to have been turned over to Ms. Marks for inspection?
Well, we do not...
Without inspection.
Under the new law, but the new law doesn't apply to this case.
Okay, well...
But under the new law, we do believe that that would be the case, but I still assert that it is an unconstitutional law that violates that history of the determinations of the Supreme Court.
Understood. And you have not obtained a ruling in the trial court on your constitutionality argument, correct?
That is correct. We did
and
not.
And we have case law that says it's not preserved if you did not receive such a ruling in the trial court.
Well, there's also case law that says that in the summary judgment, this reviewed de novo, that the court can make a determination on any issue that supports the summary judgment as long as it doesn't expand the party's rights. We're not trying to expand our rights. We're recognizing that our rights are limited. The city clerk's rights to release ballots are limited to the protection of the citizens. But I do recognize that the lower court did not address the constitutionality, but I do believe in a summary judgment proceeding, you have the authority to review that.
All right. Now, can you, setting that aside for the moment, the statute that 3110.616 was not amended at the same time that CORA was amended, correct?
Correct.
All right. So shouldn't there have been some sort of an amendment to 3110.616 if it provides as you contend? In other words, that statute has not changed. It still says the statutes must remain in the ballot box. That the votes must remain in the ballot box. And why wouldn't we look at that and say, well, this was a change in, procedure only and not in whether there could be actually an inspection prior to the enactment of the CORA amendments?
Well, I think there are two aspects of that question. One is that that particular law specifically is a new law that by its own terms does not apply to a request that occurred before the law became effective. That's the terms of House Bill 1210.36 very clearly. It only applies to requests for inspections after. It's a prospective law, and as was previously mentioned, the law itself says we intend to allow this. This becomes a specific position, a new law that has a specific provision regarding examination of ballots. I don't think the legislature was necessarily required to amend the 616. It might have been better if it had mentioned it, but I don't think it was required to amend it because it took action that was a new law changing what had occurred before. But we're here interpreting 616 as it existed prior to this new law. And this new law it's not a clarification. It's clearly a new law by its own terms, by the application of law that require presumptions that a new law is a change in the law, presumptions that it has prospective effect. It doesn't apply to this particular case and where we are now.
Couldn't it be construed that it's just a change in the procedure and not a change in whether the ballots can be inspected?
Oh, I don't agree with that at all, Your Honor. It is clearly a change in law where it says it intends to permit is going forward. It doesn't mean that in the past it permitted.
But it doesn't say it for the first time to permit. It doesn't say that there's a change in the law that ballots were not permitted to be inspected previously. You would concede that.
I can concede that, but it's clearly a prospective law in the history that exists, and the clear language of 616 indicates that it cannot be, that inspection was not allowed before that law came into effect.
Can you please point me to the language that says that inspection was not allowed before it went into effect?
only to the extent that I've already noted that it says it only applies to inspection requests after the effective date, and that it intends to permit it. I mean, it doesn't specifically say I'll reverse that, because it says this only applies to prospective or to new applications. It doesn't apply to an old application. So there's certainly a clear representation that the legislature wasn't intending to allow that before. And it's a recognition that it's a new law. And it didn't change anything. It did change something, but it's a new law. The previous interpretations of 616 have to stand.
I'm taking too much of your time, Council.
I do want to go back to 616 and the three exceptions that are set forth, because I believe the final one is the most dramatic one, and that's the one that says that when the time passes, they shall be removed from the ballot box and then destroyed. And that is a crucial language. It's not that shall be disposed of. It's not that they shall be copied and examined. They shall be destroyed. And that is very important in this consideration. Now, I recognize that although these time frames have passed, that because of the court order that was instituted in this case, the ballots have been preserved. And that was requested so that it was clear that as we went through this case, if there was a change, we weren't going to be violating any court orders. So the ballots had been preserved. But just briefly to go through a few other things is including the municipal code. Section 9.10.130 of the Aspen Municipal Code also adopts the same language. It is clear the intent, the legislative intent of that section was very clear, and that section mandates, again, destruction at the end of a particular time, and it prohibits examination. That was clearly the legislative intent. It is our position that is actually also binding and overrides court because of the effect of Article 20, Section 6 of the Colorado Constitution, which provides that a home rule city is vested with the power to legislate upon, provide, regulate, conduct, and control all matters pertaining to municipal elections in the city, in such city or town, securing the purity of elections and guarding against abuses of election franchise. We, the city of Aspen, took the opportunity to make those, to enact that law for those specific purposes under these provisions, and that prevails in this case because that, despite CORA, in any change to CORA, that would be applicable. Because under the rulings of the town of Telluride versus San Miguel Valley and Gosselinger versus the Denver Election Commission. And Gosselinger is an important case because it was a conflict between the Denver Election Commission and the open meetings law, similar to the conflict here that might be between CORA and our legislation that prohibits examination of cast ballots.
Council, are you contending that we need to construe 9.10.130 any differently than Section 31.10.616? Are you contending that construction is exactly the same for purposes of this case?
It's significantly the same. There are minor differences, but they do not change the application of that legislation to this case. And substantially similar to 31.10.616.
So that first sentence in the ordinance about notwithstanding any provisions to the contrary in 31.10.616, we don't have to.
Well, the point was brought up that Ms. Marks has contended that it would be inconsistent with conducting a recount, and we did not believe that. We did not accept that argument. We still do not accept that argument. That it's inconsistent with recount, but we were trying to address certain provisions that had been argued. But at the time it was enacted, it was after the district court had upheld the determination of what 3110.616 had meant in the Marks v. Cook case. Briefly, I've got a little over a minute, and I would like to address two things very quickly. Again, I recognize the constitutional questions that you raised about your authority, but I do believe you have the authority to do that. And if you look at the history, going back from 1876 constitutional amendment, the change in 1946, the interpretation that has occurred through the 1897 case, Gray versus Hunley in 1925, the change in the amendment in 1946 that still said examination of ballots is only allowed in court contests, and then the determination of the Supreme Court in Taylor versus Pyle and Mahaffey versus Barnhill, both of which say that examination can only occur in a court contest, and that secrecy in voting must be as vigorously defended after the election as it is before the election. And finally, on the issue of attorney's fees. Frankly, and this is an unusual case as it relates to attorney's fees, because the request for Ms. Marks was done after, the one that's operable here was done after we filed the case. And we believe that we have acted in good faith and that the attorney fees provision should not be allowed to stand against us. And I see that my time is up, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to make two quick points with respect to 3110-616 and then move on to the Aspen Municipal Ordinance. First, the city has argued that the language in 3110-616 is very clear and unambiguous. And I think what's important to remember is that this clarity and lack of ambiguity resulted in the city modifying the language of 3110-616 in passing the Aspen Municipal Ordinance 910-130. So one wonders about the clarity of 3110-616. And it's sort of related to that. I think another thing to remember as a backdrop to all of this is that when we're dealing with Title 31, substantial compliance is the relative standard. Judge Casewell, you asked before about the language of the statute. And I think another way that one can get comfortable with the idea of removing ballots for the purpose of inspection is that under the dictates of Title 31, substantial compliance is the standard. A clerk can remove these ballots, make a determination as to whether they are anonymous, in particular in light of, for example, Ms. Marks' court request that specified anonymous ballots, and then go ahead and produce those ballots that are indeed anonymous. Unless there are any questions on 3110-616, I'd like to turn to 910-130.
I have a question on attorney's fees, but I'll try not to sidetrack it too far. I was looking at the safe harbor provision of that attorney fee statute, and it says that if the custodian determines in good faith that she doesn't know if the records are discoverable, she can file an action. And yet, as I understand you to be saying, she has to say those words. She can't in good faith determine that the records are not discoverable and still be entitled to the safe harbor if she loses. Is that?
That you've hit the nail on the head, Your Honor. I think I think one has to think about the purpose of the safe harbor that exists. If a clerk truly cannot make a determination and they go into court and they say to the judge, I cannot determine whether this record is disclosable, well, this is not an adversarial proceeding at that stage. The clerk hasn't advocated one position or the other. They've gone into a court and said, please guide me. I can't figure this out. I can't determine whether I can disclose this record. In that case, the person who wants access to the record doesn't need a lawyer. They don't need an advocate to work on their behalf, because they're not fighting against a clerk who's taken the other side of the position and who has attorneys representing them. And so I think that's, against that backdrop, if you think about the provisions of 6A, there are two of them. And frankly, the city has argued a combination of both of them that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to us. One provision is that you can go into court and say, good faith, I can't determine, please tell me. And if the record has to be disclosed, we don't have to pay fees. The requester didn't have to hire an attorney. Alternatively, you can say, I believe this record should have been disclosed or is disclosable, but in order to disclose it, I would have to do substantial injury to the public interest.
Didn't she argue that in her petition, because it appends that law professor's article or something?
Exactly.
About how how it would be destructive of the public interest. Why isn't that a sufficient allegation?
Well, there are two separate allegations, right? So you're right, Your Honor. I think it, neither of them is fully fleshed out. In fact, we would argue that the city hasn't complied with either, although they've asserted both. They haven't gone into court and said, we can't determine. They did the opposite. They said, we think this is not disclosable. And then, confusingly, they said, not only do we think it's not disclosable, but we think if we were to have to disclose it, it would do substantial injury to public interest. We would submit that they not complied with either portion of Section 6A. And therefore, that the safe harbor would not apply.
In a way, this is a question, though, that's akin to whether this is a declaratory judgment action or an interpleader kind of action. Standard interpleader just says, we don't know who to whom to pay this money. Here are these two defendants. Tell us which one. And a declaratory judgment says, tell us what the law requires. We've not required formalistic pleadings since we got rid of code pleadings. Why do we have to have that here? Because it makes sense that you have to specifically make an allegation, and you can't take a position, essentially is what you're saying. You cannot take a position opposing what the applicant wants.
Your Honor, I've run out of time.
Go ahead. Finish the answer, if you would.
That's exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. I think this is a unique circumstance. And in fact, it's this court that addressed this different division of this court that addressed the issue in Benefield, the Benefield case, Colorado Republican Party in Benefield. The court was very clear that you have to come in. I think it has to do largely with the idea that this is a unique circumstance. This is a situation where we are required, where the legislature has decided that it would like citizens to act as private attorneys general, to go out and inspect public records to be able to police their government. And in that case, it felt necessary to allow those citizens to recover their attorney fees if they had to go and fight an issue out.
So the end result is the clerk will always, always take a position that, I don't know, you decide, court, and could essentially flaunt the election laws and the statutes just by saying, I don't know.
Well, but if they say, I don't know, that may not advance any purpose that they have. I mean, I think, frankly, Your Honor, what we've seen more frequently is this sort of what we would call a flawed hybrid approach, where they go ahead and advocate a position, but through the magic of semantics, go ahead and say that they don't actually know, but that this record should not be disclosed. Right? To try to rely on the safe harbor, to try to get access to the safe harbor, even though they've not come anywhere close to satisfying the requirements of it.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.